My name is Jeffrey Gruff. This is the one and only Antimatter Radio Show. It is September 17, 2009. Thank you very much for joining us today. Last week's show was something else. I'm still thinking about that. I actually just got done with Dr. Deagle's show on the Nutri Medical Report. Covering this, he did let me cover all those issues that we covered last week about the New World Order and 9/11. So if you want to hear that show, I'm going to put it up in the archives of my website's radio show website, which is antimatterradio.com. And so that'll probably be up late tonight, so you can go check that out there. Really, it's nothing over and above what was covered last week on this show, but it's nevertheless a lot more publicity for that theory that we discussed last week. So, but then this week's show, today, we're going to get back into our more normal topics that we discuss, which are archaeology, spiritual experience, religious ecstasy, light of heaven, meditation, and things such as that. Today's the second part of the show that we started, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, which was called Archaeology and Religion Not Conducive to the Mainstream View of Reality. Today's show is part two of that. The first part is in the archives at antimatterradio.com. Just go to the radio archives link there. You can hear that and also that big show from last week. And scheduled on this radio show we're going to have the Dr. Deagle show is still postponed. I was just talking to Doc, and we're going to put that off a little bit more. He's got a lot of things going on. But we'll get that up to you before the big flu outbreaks or whatever that are projected, because we have a lot of flu remedies and so forth that we want to bring across in the show. So just keep an eye on antimatterradio.com for when that's going to come up. But next week we've got a tentative series starting, tentatively. A first show of a series called The Nature of Religion, Ecstasy, Extraterrestrials, Light, Meditation, Dragons, and Divinity, Part 1. That is tentatively scheduled for next week, September 24. Then the week following, October 1st, was going to be the second part of the numerology series, but I think I'm going to put that off to October 8, because next week I want to have a follow-up to last week's show on the New World Order wanting 9/11 exposed as an inside job. Next week's show is called, or sorry, in 2 weeks we have a show called The New World Order Wants the New World Order to Fail. So it's possible that that'll be next week, but most likely that show will be in 2 weeks. I want to see how this all gets traction from what we brought up on last week's show. So regardless, a lot of exciting things. I was going to have a couple guests on these weeks, but I've postponed a lot of that. I've got some possible big guests coming up, including Dr. Deagle. That was another reason I was also kind of wanting to put Dr. Deagle off a little bit, because I want to really cover a lot of these issues to do with 9/11 and archaeology and so forth, because we're sort of laying the foundation of this show. I know this is something like the 18th or 20th show that we've done, but we're getting our foundations out now. It takes a lot of time to, I mean, we've been on the air 20 hours together here, 25 hours or so, and that's just how much time it takes to learn what's going on, because we, the human race, has been totally deceived into the nature of reality. It's complete travesty of how misled we are, so it takes a long time to figure out what's going on. You're not supposed to know overnight, you know, the big secrets or something. Sometimes the big secrets you'll find them in a book or something. It may take you years to figure out what exactly this really means. So all of humanity needs to slow down, to reflect and realize that we have a big learning process that we need to start, and when there's nothing quick about it, we're not supposed to know by next week the big secrets of the cosmos. This may take us a decade. This may take us 2 decades. But the journey to getting there is utterly enjoyable, and we get there, if there ever is really a getting there, will be absolutely wonderful. But humanity is, as I've said on this radio show and other radio shows, humanity is entering some sort of a spiritual renaissance. That is, I know that's different than the thesis I held years ago, and which I held in my book Corporatism. But that's what happens when you learn more. I've changed my thesis. I used to think we were going into a 1984 Orwellian state. Now, even though it may appear that way a little bit, I do not hold that we're going there. I hold that we're going into a spiritual renaissance, a farming, earth religion, spiritual renaissance run by the people, a genuine one. That's my hope, and that's what I believe is going on. So, and that's where this radio show comes in, to try to track these issues and discuss these issues. So today's show is the second part on the nature of religion and archaeology, specifically real archaeology. The archaeology and religion not covered in our mainstream view. Now, the mainstream view is what you get on the cable TV channels and the universities and pretty much everywhere else except what's called the alternative media area, such as BBS radio and so forth. So that's a very narrow view that you're given. It's basically all just sets of theories. You know, here's a theory. Humans came from monkeys. It's called the theory of human evolution. As we discussed in Antimatter Radio shows number 1 and 2, which are in the archives, those theories are nothing. And we need to go beyond theories. We need to go to experiential knowledge. That's knowledge that we can witness with our senses and with our deeper experiences. That's how we find out what is real. And that's what this show attempts to focus on. And what you find out is that reality is a spiritual existence. It's not a material plane. That's just a facade. What actually exists is a field of spiritual energy everywhere. Now, some people just look at me with a blank stare and with their mouth hanging open, like, what are you talking about? I don't understand at all what you mean. That's just a product of the fact that Americans and humans on planet Earth are so utterly deluded to thinking that materialist reality, the physical reality, is what is, and all there really is to that reality is war and money and taxes and striving at jobs that we don't like. Well, that is false, 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 and false. Okay, that's called fake reality. That's called humans on a deluded path. That's called humans needing to get back to their origins, their roots. Okay, because this is not at all how humans have always lived, even though some people absolutely erroneously think it was the case. The way humans have lived many times in the past is, let me just quote Henry David Thoreau. Henry David Thoreau's book, Walden, Walden, one of my favorite books I've ever read, he discusses in the whole first chapter of that book, Walden, a chapter called Economy, he discusses how it's just so interesting that the Native Americans are, the American Indians that were around in the 1800s when Thoreau wrote his book, you know, the first half of the 1800s, they were all basically rich, as he put it, and the white Europeans that came to settle in the Americas were poor. Now, what he meant by that was the following. He would go and visit the Indians, and they would all have warm, nice, beautiful houses, their sorts of houses. Sometimes they're called teepees now, and they were warm, comfortable. Everybody had the same sort of house. Nobody was impoverished to not have one. Everybody was warm, and it was relatively easy to build one. You had no debt. You didn't have to pay for it and pay a bank and work at a job you hate, so you can pay off a bank for 40 years. And there were, that left a lot of leisure time, a lot of time to sit around and carry out spiritual exercises, like taking part with the Calumet, that's called the peace pipe. And then on the other hand, Thoreau wrote about, he would go over to the huge shanty towns. Just this endless poverty accompanies Western civilization. Poverty, poverty everywhere. You know, we're supposed to be so lofty and grand in our civilization. Well, there was this incredible poverty absolutely everywhere. I mean, it's just unbelievable. We have tent cities arising in America now, 1 million people in Arizona that are homeless alone. It's just unbelievable. And we say we're the pinnacle of civilization. Time to turn off the TV and figure out the real view of reality. But anyways, Thoreau would go to the shanty towns. And this would be in the middle of winter, you know, absolutely freezing up there in Massachusetts, where Thoreau lived. And he would see just rows and rows and rows, just incredible amounts of people in these shanty towns, all with absolutely freezing cold homes. Sometimes the door wouldn't even work, and the wind would blow right in. Their clothes were not adequate, so these people were freezing. And this was all a product of Western civilization, and these people had to work incredibly hard just to get enough of a wage to pay for this pathetic existence, working in incredible, incredibly unfavorable jobs, long hours. So in Thoreau's perspective, the white Europeans were poor and the Native Americans, the American Indians, were rich. The Native Americans had spiritual history, spiritual experience. Ecstasy, that's called, spiritual ecstasy. They had leisure time. They had time for family. They were warm. They all had nice homes. And on the other hand, hordes of Europeans had none of that. So it's just amazing. Amazing, amazing to read Thoreau's, which his really is what's an anthropology book, is what it is, on the history of our Western civilization. So that's kind of where I want to go today, talking about actual religion, actual spirituality, actual archaeology. When we look at the archaeology with our own eyes, and we really go and study the ruins and monuments around the world, we find out that we have no idea how it was the whoever it was that lived on planet Earth in the past created the things that they did. Okay, so it's kind of funny. When I got my undergrad degree in anthropology, we did not study these things. We just studied modern hunter-gatherers, and I got my degree from the University of New Mexico. We would not study things like Stonehenge and the pyramids and Tiahuanaco and the underwater cities, the ruins of cities in off Japan and Spain and India and so forth, underwater pyramids. We would instead study largely irrelevant things, and I just find that very odd that that's the way we conducted our anthropological study when I was getting my undergrad degree in the mid-90s at the University of New Mexico. And let me unplug a phone here. So basically, when you study anthropology from that perspective, it allows you to build up a theory. The theory goes as follows. Humans were very poor and slavish in the past, and gradually through time learned more and more technology and got more and more advanced, and here we are today at the most advanced state. So that's a wonderful theory. Keyword there is emphasized theory. But the problem is if you actually go look at archaeology all over the world, it's completely destroyed, and the theory falls away to the fact. I use the word fact because that has to do with what you can see with your eyes, not just some theory you make up. It falls away with the fact that our ancestors were more advanced than we are, period. Yeah, there's really no way around it. When you've got monuments that we cannot figure out how to build, like Baalbek, like as I've discussed in past editions of the Antimatter Radio Show, we have to accept the fact that our current view of history, the academic view of history, actually needs to be turned the opposite way, that we're in a declining, we have been in a declining state, as Walter Crutton discussed in this show a few weeks back. We may be on the upswing again because we're more advanced, apparently, from the as we were from in the Middle Ages. But we were have been in a declining state overall, besides the recent uptick over the last 1,000 years, since the times of Sumeria and before. And there's a lot of researchers talk about Atlantis. Michael Tesarian, for example, talks about Atlantis, saying that that was the civilization that was the precursor to Sumeria, and that was the ultra-advanced civilization. That does sort of fit with what Walter Crutton was saying when he was saying that the height of civilization was back, you know, sometime around 8,000, 10,000 BC. That was a much more advanced time than now. So what we have to understand is that the current view is difficult for people to accept because, the new view that I'm discussing here is different than the current view, and therefore the new view is difficult for people to accept due to the fact that when people are taught things before the age of 6, it's hard for them to overturn that. They'll often, I think it was Stalin who said, if you give me a child before the age of 6, I can turn them into anything I want them to be, because you can sort of imprint their minds. That's why our jobs as parents is so incredibly important here in America and worldwide. So let's get to some of these specific issues. I've got a whole page here in front of me of what can be discussed. I think what I'd like to talk about first is magnetic forces and healing energies, because that's in line with what we discussed last week at the end of the show, or two weeks ago, the first edition of this series. Now, this may be hard to for some of you to understand, but I'm looking at a book right now called Quantum Touch. on my bookshelf. And this book, which I have read and began to start practicing, indicates that there are special energies that we can channel through our body, through our hands, which are healing forces. Okay, so in other words, there are certain meditative exercises you can do, which will increase the level of energy into your body. You can channel that energy to your hands, and if you touch a person, a cat, a dog, whatever, a living entity, a biological entity, you will bring it healing power. Okay, basically, what you do is you carry out, we're going to have a couple shows in the future on meditation. I realize I've never discussed meditation much on this show, other than the fact that it's important it exists. But we will discuss that much more in the future. But if you carry out basic Buddhist meditation at the very high level, after you've gotten adept at doing it, high level is not some lofty, prestigious title. It just is, means basically you've gotten used to knowing what you're doing, knowing how to do carry out meditation, and you know how to instantly get to an alpha state of consciousness, for example. What happens in that state is there are energy, your body increases in your through your consciousness, your body increases its level of energy. And it's not really clear exactly what these energies are. If it's electricity, if it's magnetism, if it's some unknown energy, some mixture of these. And you can consciously and telementationally focus the energy into your hands. And if you touch another person, you will do such healing to them that it's almost difficult to believe. For example, this book Quantum Touch describes is a scenario where an older woman had a bent over back. She was all hunched over forward. And with the healing hands therapy, the quantum touch therapy, over the course of doing this for about an hour, this meditation, he was able to fully heal her back so she was utterly straight. Now, in our materialistic, de-spiritualized American culture, this is very hard to believe, and I know it's different than what all the university professors tell you. But I've been forced, I used to teach in academia, I used to teach philosophy at Purdue University and Indiana University. Now I don't anymore because I've been forced on to different paths, different avenues, because I have found that there are these other avenues that exist. When I discovered telementation years back, I discovered it in the process of doing my Buddhist meditation that I do daily. I was rather stunned to know that this power exists, that it's not covered by academic science. It's not that they can't discover it, they just ignore it completely for reasons we've discussed in past shows, such as where the funding for academia comes from and so forth, steers it. And so funding doesn't go towards studying things like telementational energy. So anyways, it's difficult for people to grasp this, but this is the reality of nature. This is the reality of reality. And we have to start to understand that there's a whole lot of power and a whole lot of forces and energy that we don't know about, but yet we are made of these. They are ancient forces, ancient powers, which our ancient ancestors knew about. Things like numerology, palmistry, healing hands therapy, sun worship, which we discussed last week, the power of nirvana, which we discussed last week, the chakras, which I'm going to discuss here in a few minutes. Our ancestors knew about all this stuff, yet we, for some reason, are shielded this. It's not just that we don't know about them overall in our culture, and for the few that do know about it, they have a hard time delving into this, into the topics deeply, because they don't know where to get information, they don't know where to get instruction, and so forth. It's important, though, to realize that there's only one force, really, that exists, and that's responsible for all of these issues that I'm discussing today. I call that force telementation. I don't know exactly what it is. A lot of people want to say it's an energy field, and that's great. I do that, too, sometimes. Some people want to say it's quantum weirdness, quantum stuff, and I do that sometimes, too. But more and more these days, what I like to say is I don't really know what this force is. When I carry out meditation, I get a certain religious joy, to put it crudely. I get a certain spiritual power that I can't even really believe exists still. Because, as everybody else, I was trained to think in my youth, these things did not exist. But we have to understand that there is this one power specifically hidden from us in the way our culture is set up. And it's not necessarily the case that in academia we just don't know about it. It's specifically hidden from us by New World Order forces, government forces, that know about these powers and want to hoard them for themselves. These are the most powerful aspects of the universe. So it makes sense that they want to keep these powers for themselves. So while they're studying things like numerology, while the New World Order and the secret government that controls the world is operating through numerology, these quantum energies such as healing hands energy, sacred geometry, telementation, palmistry, astrology, and so forth, they'll use all these, but they will in the same process tell us that through the media that all these are ridiculous and only superstitious weirdos indulge in these things. And also, they will show us pathetic examples of them. They'll put Dionne Warwick on the psychic network. And, I mean, she may or may not be some kind of psychic. I have no idea. But what they'll do is they'll make her look kind of silly on TV. And then, so therefore, people will associate psychic powers with just sort of nothing, okay? And all it takes is just a small amount of instruction to show you that that's all a lie, that psychic powers are the nature. Your consciousness is actually a psychic power. The ego state of consciousness, though, which is the lowest level state of consciousness, the fear and desire state, is actually a tip of the iceberg, which what you can call psychic power. Just slightly below this, and more deep than that, ego consciousness are all these cosmic energies, like telementation. I mean, that's what consciousness is all these cosmic energies. This healing hands energy that I described as quantum touch energy is telementational energy. Is magnetism. I've been doing a lot of magnetic therapy, as I've discussed in past shows. And I really just can't quite believe how reading a book on magnetism and meditation and using some magnetics therapeutically and using a magnetic pill and so forth, I really can't believe how well it has supercharged my meditation. I mean, meditation was going well before, but now it's turbo. So magnetism is one of these special forces, and it's sort of the same kind of stuff that my consciousness is made of. It's sort of the same kind of stuff that all these spiritual powers that make up the cosmos are made of. And, you know, and here's another thing. All our ancestors knew all about numerology and sacred geometry, spiritual energies, telementation, and so forth, as I discussed last week. But, yeah, we're specifically told that, oh, no, the real science isn't that. That's all just crazy quackery. And, I mean, literally, just go pay attention to the mass media whenever they talk about alternative medicine or something, and you'll see them bring that up. They'll say, that's all crazy, and what you really need to focus on is, yeah, here's a great theory, the theory of Darwinian human evolution. Okay, I really don't even know what to say. There is no evidence for that. There is no genetic evidence. I mean, if that was a true theory, great. I don't have any problem thinking I was some butt-sniffing monkey millions of years ago. Really, I just want to know the facts, the truth. I want to know where the evidence leads, and it does not lead there. But it's just, I guess it's just really, really sad. I'm genuinely saying that we as humans can't get past that. We can't get to an evidential science, an experiential scientific worldview. We can't get to anything beyond that. You know, we've got theoretical science, which dominates our universities. You base everything in the university on theory, and you do experiments to try to support the theory, rather than try to do experiments to destroy the theory. That's the key. That's the key difference right there. You don't want to do experiments to support a theory. You want to do an experiment to destroy a theory. That's what Karl Popper, the famous philosopher, discussed. He said, "What you want to do when you're doing science is you want to try to falsify, or in other words, disprove your theories. Therefore, what do? The theory falls apart, and you come up with a modified theory, which is stronger." Okay, and then, but that one's still not quite right, so you want to try to attack it, and you just keep doing this forever and ever, and you get a more fine-tuned view of reality. Unfortunately, our universities are not doing this. They are doing experiments and which try to build up the theory rather than destroy it. So they're not into falsification so much as they are into reinforcement. So it's very sad. I know, I mean, I live in West Lafayette, Indiana here, and that's all I really see is, animal studies and genetically modified food and all these researches around here. It's just pretty much disgusting. I don't really want to talk about it. So let's talk about the chakras, which you talked about. I said I talked about a few minutes ago. Chakras are usually purported to be energy centers in the body, you know, with the head and the heart and above the stomach and groin area and so forth. And these are supposedly can become energized in meditation, and that's some sort of significant step in meditation. I agree with all that. Here's the thing, though, which is very, very, very rarely discussed. The chakras are actually based on physiology, on anatomy. Okay, if you, for example, I've got a book sitting right here called The Heart Math. There it is, Heart Math Solution by Childry and Martin. And I guess they have a whole institute, and so their movement's getting pretty big. I'm reading this book, and what they're basically telling me here is that the heart is not just a blob of muscle. It's not just a pump. How do we know this? Well, we very specifically know this scientifically because guess what they found in the heart? They found dopamine, a lot of it, significant amounts. Now, what's dopamine? That's a neurotransmitter. Amazing. Now, I know that dopamine, everybody thinks, back when I taught at the universities, the students would think that dopamine this, dopamine that, they would take their psychology classes and think the only brain chemical that existed was dopamine. That's because the pharmaceutical companies are concerned with it because of their depression drugs. But dopamine is actually not one of the more significant neurotransmitters. It's sort of a middle level. There's 1,000 or more neurotransmitter chemicals in the brain. But the point here is you're finding a neurotransmitter in the heart. Why in the world is a neurotransmitter found in significant degree in the heart? Okay, why don't we ask the Darwinians that? Okay, because they're going to have to tell us if they want to hold the thesis that dopamine is a consciousness chemical, has to do with human thought and consciousness, then how did their evolution account for consciousness being in the heart? Which is interestingly is something that Aristotle, the ancient Greek philosopher, who came up with that premise that thought and consciousness is in the heart, not in the brain. So anyway, that's just a side note, but it would be interesting to get the Darwinians' take on that. They would probably come up with some crazy theory. Notice the key word there again is theory, to try to explain it. So the point here is that you've got, I basically take any chemical neurotransmitter in the brain is some sort of very special spiritual substance of some sort. Spiritual meaning it's doing things interrelated in us with consciousness. Okay, I mean if you study my brain, you can find out that the activities of my brain are associated with my consciousness. Okay, now we don't see consciousness in the brain. We can't see your thoughts and feelings inside your brain. So we can't therefore conclude that consciousness is identical to your brain. It's just part of your brain. That would be a that'd be going into the theoretical. What we do know, though, is that your consciousness is correlated with brain activity. So if the two are not identical, and the consciousness is immaterial and the brain is the matter stuff, the two are working together in an interesting way. So therefore, I take, you know, so that's neurotransmitters that are doing the work there. So I take these neurotransmitters as a very special sort of stuff, especially since, like I just said, your consciousness is basically a divine psychic force. So therefore, these chemicals are associated with this divine psychic force. They have something special, some very special role to play in this, in allowing this pod or whatever. I used to call it a biopod earlier in my academic days, of what the brain is, which is this, it's a pod or a vehicle or something that allows consciousness to manifest in this physical reality, which is not the real reality, of course. It's the subreal reality. So anyway, the point here is that you've got this substance found in the heart. And then let's move further now. Down below the heart, above the stomach, is a large complex of neurons. I apologize. I was trying to find, just before the show, the name of it. I've forgotten the name of it. Just go look it up on Google. Look up neural assemblage stomach or something like that on Google, and you should get right to it, something like that. But there's above the stomach is a very significant assemblage of neurons right in the area where another chakra is supposed to be. So do you see a pattern forming here? You've got the brain, which is a chakra location, according to the ancients, and it's filled with all its spiritual chemicals like serotonin and dopamine, and there's another one called GABA, GABA. That's the biggest neurotransmitter, I believe. And then the heart is a location of a chakra, and it's filled with those same psychic spiritual chemicals. Now we've got another location where there's a chakra, the stomach region just above it, also filled with the same psychic spiritual chemicals of consciousness. So do you understand here that people like to mock the whole chakra thing quite a bit? You know, oh, how silly, the ancients coming up with a little meditation game. But it's actually physiology. There's two questions here. A, how is it the case that they knew and we didn't? And it's three questions. B, what does it all mean? And C, how on earth did we get constructed and created to have this? This is almost like another disproof of Darwinism, at least the current version of Darwinism. Because these are spiritual centers, okay? So I don't think the Darwinians have a good model for why we have spiritual ecstasy. I think actually they would say it's bad for survivability, because, of course, Darwinism is based on survival of the fittest and the genetic traits surviving from one generation to the next. But I think spiritual ecstasy is not conducive to survival because, for example, if you're in spiritual ecstasy out there in the plains in Native America or something, gazing up at the star in your spiritual joy, feeling the light of heaven with your eyes closed and your mouth open, you're going to get eaten by a cougar. Okay, so it's almost as if spiritual ecstasy is not conducive to Darwinian natural selection. Now, these are just, I've thought about these theories through the years, but I'm just rattling this one off. This would have to be, I'm not trying to make some hard claim, I'm just throwing this out for food for thought. So, but the point is just, our three points here are, how is it possibly the case that we were designed to have these chakra systems? How did the ancients know and we don't? And what does it all mean? So there's something just absolutely huge going on right here. So this is ancient science. Notice I used the word science there. Didn't even mean to do that. But it is an ancient science. The modern world is not aware of this. It's not conducive to the mainstream view because the human body is supposed to be sort of just a machine, not a spiritual, not a vessel specifically created for spiritual ecstasy, which the chakra system clearly is. So there's something just explosive here to understand about our physical bodies. I've got a book here by Manly P. Hall called The Occult Anatomy of Man. I'm going to read that book, and I bet you he's going to have some of that, some of this discussed in there. Now I know Manly P. Hall's a Freemason, and everybody starts to get all nervous and jittery when I bring up his name, but as I've discussed on an article I posted on RestoreTheRepublic.com, I don't have a whole lot of fear over the Freemasons. They're just a, it's only the high-level infiltrating Illuminati they have to worry about. So you can go to antimatterradio.com, go to political writings, on the left-hand side, a link there, and you'll see my article in there about the Freemasons and why it's nothing to worry about. I quote David Icke in there. The article's based on a quote of his. So it's pretty good take on it. The Freemasons are just a distraction. They're not the real problem. The problem is the Illuminati. Anyways, so this is just wonderful, in my opinion. This idea that our physiology is not a Darwinian machine. It is not a vessel just meant to reproduce, excrete, consume food, go to war, and sleep like a slob. Okay, what it is meant is it's specifically a spiritual vessel. Now, this is your reason. If you've ever had wanted a reason to get into herbology or herbalism and start an exercise program, start lifting weights. I lift weights all the time. Eat the best foods. Eat foods, you know, indulge in omega oils and hemp oils and so forth. This, I mean, this is your reason. Your body is apparently, it's not, a lot of people, even in the East, they often say, the body doesn't matter, it's the consciousness. Now, I don't disagree with that. I mean, that's very, I'm a Buddhist, and that's very Buddhistic tenet. But we might be going beyond that here. There's a lesson we're learning here from this physiology of the chakra system. Okay, it might be the case that that's not necessarily true. It might be the case that the body is some sort of spiritual temple. It's right there in our physiology. Okay, right? I mean, the heart math people are onto this. Other people, I presume, are onto this. So there's something really powerful. So we've got our healing hands energy that we've discussed and the chakra system. These two go together. The healing hands energy shows that our whole body is this conduit, this vessel for unknown spiritual energies that just are of incredible healing joy in almost ways that are so bizarre that it's hard to even discuss them on the airwaves because they're so different than our TV reality that it's hard for us to understand our materialist fake reality that isn't even fully real. So, now let's move on to another similar and related topic, and that's the ley lines. Now, it's well known in alternative media that there are certain energy concentration areas on Earth, and that's where often we find places that the Catholic Church sets up their buildings, and or we have government buildings there. So somebody knows that these forces are there. Somebody pre-plans building their architecture on them. It can't be a coincidence because it's always so uniform in how, where the ley lines are, the energy forces, the energy concentrations are. You find, for example, buildings that the Catholic Church has built on them. So this implies to us that behind the scenes there's a whole culture of people or something else that knows about these forces, is specifically trying to keep them from the mainstream media, make sure to keep them keep them from the people, making sure they keep them out of the mainstream media and use the media to talk about ridiculous stuff like the Michael Jackson funeral and all this other crap. You know, how many touchdowns Brett Favre threw last week? Like, we haven't heard that story 50 million times before. So now the thing is what are these energies? I'm reading a book on ley lines right now, but it appears to me, here's what I'm starting to understand. There are all kinds of energies out there. Nobody really knows exactly what they are. I know if you take your physics class in college, they want to tell you there's just, you know, four kinds of energy: electromagnetism, gravity, strong and weak nuclear forces. Well, that's a bunch of bunk. There's something. What is this healing hands energy? Okay. What is consciousness? What energy is that? Because it's certainly, you can't tell me it doesn't exist. And if you sit there and tell me it's just neurons in the brain, well, then you're going back to that same old academic theoretical mess. Because that's there. If consciousness is part of the brain, show me consciousness in the brain right now. I want to go into some. I want to go to a brain. Go to brain surgery at a hospital. I want to look inside someone's brain and see the thoughts in there. I want to see the feelings. I want to see someone think about 2 + 2 = 4, and I want to see the thought in their head. You know what? You never can do that. So therefore, we don't have evidence that the consciousness is part of the brain. So therefore, we can't do that. So consciousness exists. Our evidence that is that it's not part of the brain. Our evidence is that it's also, we can look right at consciousness inside ourselves. I can see my feelings. I can see my thoughts. I can feel them, experience them, and they're not like physical things like this table right here. Okay, which it doesn't have those properties of materiality, so it has to be a different force. So I've got direct evidence that a non-material psychical force exists. So what kind of energy is that? Is that electromagnetism? Is that magnetism? Is it related to them, a mixture of them? Is it that and some other forces? So there's all kinds of forces. We don't necessarily know exactly what they are, and it's important to note that they directly affect the meditative and ecstatic levels of our consciousness. Okay, if you apply certain energies to this biopod called the brain, your meditation will explode with productivity. And trust me, it's worth it. Trust me, when you get into meditation, nothing else matters. You become addicted to it, and it's just a drunkenness that you want to have all the time. And and people instantly, oh no, addicted. No, it's not that kind of addiction. It's an addiction of love. You start to have acceptance for humanity and love of humanity, and you start to become a good parent, and you start to do your job well, and you just are filled with peace and joy. Okay, so the energies that are around us appear to be the bedrock of the cosmos. They appear to be what the cosmos is actually made of. Because if I rip apart matter and try to find out what matter is made of, all I come to is all these unknown energies that nobody really can explain, or nobody has any really idea what they are. So it's interesting, though, with meditation, we can find these energies, we can steer them, we can control them. So consciousness is like some sort of master power of all the energies. Now, of course, keeping in mind that the energies really might be just many faces of the one energy, as I discussed earlier. That's not really what I'm discussing at this exact moment. Now, our ancients knew about all this. They built their pyramids on these energy areas. But something that's kind of funny here is that our archaeology will show us, you know, we've got huge pyramids with big blocks all cut perfectly placed on top of each other. They didn't even settle into the ground. They didn't crack, and they're perfectly placed there. They're so heavy we can't even lift them up with our current technology. But where's all the machines that they used to build them? Okay, where's all the everything? You know, people make these theories that there was a ramp. I think Jim Nienhuis was on a couple weeks back, and he was going along with that theory. That's great. Maybe that's what happened. You know, there's a ramp to slide up the boulders to build the pyramids in Egypt. That's all wonderful, but the problem is it's theory. Okay, I'm sick of theories, if you can't tell. Okay, I mean, we can make theories up all day long to try to explain things according to a certain worldview, but unfortunately, I'm just not going to believe it until I have something more concrete, like something I can see with my own eyes, because I've just seen too many times in my life where somebody comes along with some theory which supposedly sounds great, and everybody buys it, like theory of evolution, and then you find out later, oops, there's no evidence, and then, oh, it was wrong all along. Okay, Isaac Newton is a good example of that. Actually, his was not so theoretical. His idea of forces, those were entirely theoretical. And what do you know? That's actually a good example. They were found to be wrong. His forces were in, like, Faraday, a physicist later, 200 years later, he came up with a similar theory of forces, sort of like they were lines of energy or something between objects, some sort of strings of power between entities. Like gravity is a, you know, something like if you drop the rock, the gravity pulls the rock to the earth. Okay, so there's this pulling entity. Now we found out later, though, in quantum physics, that there is no continuous string-like entity or string-like something going from the Earth to the rock. Because if you delve down, or any of these forces, like electricity, too. It's also, I mean, in magnetism, you can see the magnet pull the piece of iron towards it. And so you surmise that there's some sort of invisible string-like something pulling A to B. Okay, but if you can specifically study that magnetism, the magnetic force, and you find out that it's just a set of particles. Okay, particles which are very strange and don't act anything like material entities at all, and they're discontinuous from each other, they're not attached to anything. So there's a great example of a very prestigious theory falling flat on its face. You see why I just don't like theories? So that's why I'm not going to buy these. So anyway, these theories about the pyramids and ramps and all that, and all the other millions of theories people can come up with about how to fit the ancient world in some little box according to our perspective that we have of the world now, which is, of course, not a full perspective. So the point that I was trying to bring up, though, is that the ancients don't show any I mean, we have all these monuments, but why not tools to build the monuments? It's possible, due to the fact that these monuments are so different from anything that we currently understand now, since we can't build them, and we don't know what they're for, we don't know how they were constructed, don't know how the rocks were lifted up or cut, and everything else. Due to the fact that the entities, the artifacts themselves, the archaeological sites themselves, are so beyond our current understanding, I can therefore make the simple conclusion, yes, it's a theory, but it's a very non-risky theory since I'm just following directly from the archaeological evidence. I can therefore make the theory, the simple jump, to say that the way they constructed these things also is a way that we don't understand in any clear way and is possibly of an order unknown to us. Okay, so they may have had a way of constructing these things which has to do with consciousness, for example, because clearly the ancients were concerned with consciousness, concerned with the spiritual energies of the earth and the universe. So therefore, their technologies were those. So therefore, what they constructed probably was also being used or were being constructed with these higher-level spiritual technologies. Now, that's a theory. I don't know if it's right. But I'm just trying to come up with something based on the archaeological evidence. Okay? So, in agreement with Walter Crutton, it's just the ancients were far ahead of us, and their high-level technology was meditation. So, let's discuss now something I don't think I've ever heard discussed anywhere ever on radio, and I want to talk about dragons. And it's what I've not heard anywhere else is what I'm specifically going to discuss about dragons. And this has to do with religion and archaeology not conducive to the mainstream view of reality. The ancients were very concerned with dragons. And all the religious books, including the Bible, discuss how the ancient world was populated with dragons everywhere. All right? I'm not talking about snakes like the serpent in the Garden of Eden. I'm talking about dragons. The difference. Dragons have legs. Snakes don't. Dragons often have wings and breathe fire. Snakes don't. Now, everywhere in the world, dragons, except for very few cases, like such as Middle Age mythology, the dragons were considered peaceful and wonderful, almost like guardian angels or angels. Now, you'll be interested to know that this also includes Christianity. Because if I just take a look at the book of Isaiah 6, 1 and 2, we find that there was this king named Uzziah who died and saw a vision of God. Sorry, not a vision of God. He died and therefore saw. This is what it says in the book. You can believe it if you want or whatever. I'm just going to tell you. So I want to reference something about dragons in here. That's why I'm reading it. So this king died and was taken to God, and what he saw was God sitting there, and behind, next to and behind him were what are called seraphims. Those are dragons with six wings. Okay? So you have to conclude that these seraphims were angels if you, according to the Christian perspective, the workers of God that he created, he, she, it created, are angels. So therefore, if he's surrounded by a bunch of dragons, these dragons are angels. Okay, so now you have to couple that with the idea that in the Chinese culture, the dragon is highly revered, and there's the Chinese dragon is very popular in pop culture, and people get tattoos of the Chinese dragon and so forth. And it's usually thought that this is something cute and nice. But it's kind of interesting when you note that the seraphim is often very similar to the Chinese dragon with the multiple wings and so forth, and it's almost a guardian angel type of entity. Now, we have in our popular culture, we're told that the dragon is evil, Godzilla, and there's this movie called Dragon Wars and all this kind of stuff. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and you don't have to believe it. You can believe whatever you want. But I'm just going to tell you. So do what you want with the information. And when you're in the highest states of meditation, highest states meaning you've done hard work and you're getting towards a nirvanic state, let me just put it this way. You may have visions of a dragon or dragons. And then when you go take that, I say vision because I don't want to commit to the idea that it's not a vision, it's something real that's standing next to you and was always there, like a guardian angel. I just want to, let's just leave it at that. What will happen then if you go look up, after this episode during your meditation, if you go look up on the computer, look up Chinese dragon, pull up a bunch of images, you will find out that that dragon looks astonishingly like the one in your meditation experience. So, conclusion is that the dragon permeating mythology and culture and for the ancients, like, I mean, look at the Mayans. They were utterly obsessed with serpent dragons and some kind of serpentine dragon-like creatures. We have to therefore, I mean, here's the conclusion right here. These ancients were operating on this level of consciousness. Okay, and you might say, well, big deal. They were, people now can do that. No, here's the point. They built sculptures and monuments to this dragon consciousness. Okay, we don't. We build them to banks and money and all this, and military and all this kind of stuff. The ancients were building, I'm not saying the ancients are great and glorifying them, because we know that there are problems, you know, the Mayans sacrificing children and so forth. We know that, I'm not going to make a lot of conclusions and you know, call these groups evil and stuff, but I don't really understand what these groups were doing. That's the way I'm going to leave it, okay? So the point is here, is the ancients and the leaders of the ancient world, or whoever it was that was in charge of building all these monuments, were very likely operating out of dragon consciousness, the consciousness, the nirvanic like consciousness I just described. Okay, so now this is a theory, but I'm just connecting a couple dots to come to the theory. So I don't know if the theory's right, but it's I find it interesting. So there's something when you're inundated with these spiritual energies, the psychic energies, and you're operating on your spiritual plane rather than your egotistical plane, the fear and desire state. This, you may see creatures, entities, guardian angels, and you might say, you might have this thought in your mind, like, they were there all along, I knew you were there all along, I could always feel you there with me. Now I know you're there with me. And then we find out that our ancient ancestors were obsessed with these creatures also. So this almost verifies, I mean, if this theory is right, this verifies what Cretton was saying in his book, and he said on this show a couple weeks back, that the ancients were meditators. Okay, they were not Saturnalius, which means, you know, the orgiastics, like the Dionysian revelers. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, I'm just saying I think that our ancients were, they were beings of the dragon consciousness. All right. And I think that's very interesting. That's wonderful. It tells me that that might be our true state of consciousness. And all we need to do is alter the earth energies or whatever these cycles of history. So according to Cruttenden, weeks back on the show, in his book Lost Star, he discusses how civilization goes through these cycles up and down, golden age to dark age. And then in the golden age, which we're definitely not in now, far from, and we don't understand thoroughly, the technology then was meditation and spiritual. If we can even know really what was going on then, there were spiritual powers that were the physics and the forces then, not anything that such as we discuss now. Or else maybe we're just getting glimpses of them now. So I think what that tells us is that we need to learn how to use technologies to alter our consciousness. We need to find these spiritual energies, such as magnetism, like I was just discussing with magnetic therapy. We need to find these technologies, apply them to these temples that we have called our physical bodies, and this physiology of the chakra system that we have, this physiology of our psychic chemicals in our brain need to be activated. I mean, the pineal gland, there's another thing. I mean, I forgot that researcher's name who's discussed the pineal gland so much. It looks like it's a little gland in the middle of your head. It's not really part of the brain. It's just a gland right beneath the brain. People often call it part of the brain. It's really not, though. It's like a pine cone. It's really an eye inside your head. It has all kinds of retinal-like structures to it. So the Darwinians, of course, are going to be completely lost on how to describe that. Now, animals have this too, lizards and so forth. So it is said that the ancients were obsessed with this. The reason why it is said that they were obsessed with the pineal gland is because there's all these ancient heroes and so forth that will wear pine cone hats or have a pine cone on their forehead or have pine cone staffs. I mean, there's a little bit too much of an obsession than you'd expect that the ancients had with pine cone art. I mean, who cares about a pine cone? Why not draw anything else? Why does it repeatedly show up over and over and over again? The thesis then is that this has to do with the pineal gland because the pineal gland has all sorts of spiritual implications. Example one, it produces DMT. And DMT is an absolute spiritual psychedelic substance. If you have a sufficient enough amount of it in your body, you will have utterly ecstatic experiences of the light of God, the intelligence of the cosmos, the intelligent creative force. So, there's that, and there's many other peculiarities about the pineal gland, which lead us to believe that there's something spiritual about it. It's almost like the chakra system again. It's a spiritual aspect of the body. It's part of our spiritual anatomy, overriding this idea that we're a machine. We have a machine anatomy or Darwinian anatomy because there's certain these things that shouldn't be there. So the pineal gland is another one that's there, this eye in the center of our head. Now, interestingly, Descartes, the very famous philosopher who I like him to some degree. He's gotten a lot of flack, but he's got some pretty interesting things. He, back in, I think it was the 1700s when he wrote, now he's, of course, very famous, implicated in being part of the creator of calculus, partially with Leibniz, and one of the creators of science and so forth with Francis Bacon. But he, he states in one of his writings, I forgot which one, that consciousness is created in the pineal gland. Now, why in the world would he say that? Okay, one of our most famous philosophers from a couple hundred years back. I mean, why? I mean, this is just very curious. The what made him? I mean, what evidence does he have for that? He didn't present it. And then you have the ancients obsessed with the pineal gland. So there's some sort of spiritual powers that the pineal gland seems to embody with this chemical DMT that it produces and other aspects of it. Now, this chemical DMT is sort of neurotransmitter-like in a way that it's a chemical that is coordinated with the workings of consciousness, almost as if to create and help and be conducive to certain states of consciousness, such as complete spiritual inebriation and ecstasy. Okay? And most people listening to the show don't really even know what that stuff means. You know, what does spiritual inebriation mean? You have to do meditation, as I've said in past shows. I've done it. I've tried to figure it out, and I think I have a taste in my book, Telementation, which I hope all of you can buy for $9 on Amazon, because that gives me money to try to keep doing my research and to try to learn more for myself and then share it for anybody else who wants to listen. So these spiritual forces are interacting with our body. Our ancient ancestors knew all about that. And it appears to be the cases we're going to discuss pretty soon when we have the first show on the nature and philosophy of religion. We're going to discuss how it's not clear at all that our ancestors were alone. Okay, in other words, they may have had what's called ancient astronauts or extraterrestrials visiting them or guiding them or somehow interrelated with them in the past. Now, this is a difficult theory for many to accept because they've not been told about this. And also, they've not been shared the evidence. We're led to believe that there is no evidence for ancient extraterrestrials on planet Earth influencing or shaping or genetically modifying or engineering humans. But our religious texts are obsessed with this idea. Every single religion is obsessed with the idea. And then there's all kinds of landing strips all over South America. There's all this art, and the cave paintings, and in Renaissance art and Middle Ages art, all is filled with UFOs and star creatures, and the Book of Ezekiel in the Bible discusses spacecrafts and whatnot. So it's not clear that all this ancient technology that our ancient ancestors had was caused by them, created by them, or is just the product of an elevated level of consciousness that a golden age brings rather than our dark age or bronze age that we're in, as Cruttendon discussed a few weeks back on the show. It appears to be the case that either humans were accompanied by super beings or were helped out by them. Now, I don't know if they were just associated with them or helped out by them, but there's certainly enough reason to take it seriously, the possibility that they were here or they could still be here. In the Bible, in Genesis 6, as many of you know, Genesis has two creation stories. It's got the one in Genesis 1 where God created humans, and then Genesis 6, right in the beginning of the book there, has the second one where we're told that these fallen angels or these giant people are called the Nephilim. And there's different versions of the Bible. Sometimes they're called giants, sometimes they're called fallen angels, they're called sons of God. They're called, who knows exactly what they are, but they came to earth and were on the earth, and they reproduced with human women to create the leaders back then. This is pretty astounding. The whole Book of Enoch, which is one of the books curiously left out of the Bible, is all about this group. But curiously, that was left out of the Bible, and it's curious that this is in the Bible at all. I mean, it's exactly what are called the conspiracy theorists, what they've been saying through the years, is that there's a partially human or non-human subgroup of entities that are apparently of vaster intelligence, who have genetically modified us or have enslaved us without our knowing, and they rule the world in secret. Well, that's right there in Genesis 6. So if that's a conspiracy theory, then I guess so is the Book of Genesis, is a conspiracy theory. Most religion is sort of castigated to being conspiracy theory anyways, because now we're supposed to believe this theoretical view that the scientists and academia give us about Darwinism and all these other theories. So I like the more evidential view, as I've stated, where we base our beliefs on what we can see, such as all these ancient ruins and what's written in these ancient texts and so forth, not just some idea that, oh, it's theoretically likely that monkeys turned into humans. It's not likely, first of all. We need evidence to say it's likely, and the evidence doesn't exist, as I discussed in the first two editions of this radio show. So, let's discuss... there's just so much more to discuss. Let's discuss Tiwanaku. Tiwanaku is another one of these, speaking of South America, is another one of these amazing monuments that exists. And the it's the border of Brazil with what country? I think it's Peru. I can't remember. But it's way up in the Andes Mountains, way above the tree line. There's a lake up there called Lake Titicaca. And there's a set of ruins there, big, huge blocks, 100 tons, all perfectly cut and put into place, and you can't even fit a paper clip in between them, because they've not settled and cracked or anything, and it's pretty astonishing that they exist. Now, nobody knows how these things were lifted up, and a lot of times people try to tell us that in Egypt, you just get enough slaves trying to lift up a rock and they can lift up a 200-ton boulder or something. I find that highly and undesirably theoretical. But hey, nevertheless, that's what people say. So, but the problem is that theory kind of falls apart when you discuss Tiwanaku, because the idea that, slaves got together and pushed these rocks around in some theoretical way falls apart there, because in Tiwanaku, the monuments were built above the tree line where nobody can hardly even breathe, let alone push big 100-ton boulders around, cut them up, and perfectly put them into place. So it's very strange that these theories exist, and because Tiwanaku seems to challenge enormously this idea that slaves could push around these big, huge boulders at Baalbek and so forth to put them together. Now, those theories are highly challenged anyways. But Tiwanaku is just a good way to think about that. So, all throughout the ancient texts, we've got all kinds of accounts of flying machines and nuclear weapons that are kind of like nuclear weapons and plagues induced by God. That's the Old Testament has that. We don't really know who God is in the Old Testament. Jehovah is sort of a pretty mean dude. So, some people like myself wonder if that was just some warlord or something. There's a book by a guy named Jack Berenger called Past Shock, which discusses this. And so there's all kinds of technologies and machines and spiritual technologies and so forth that the ancients had, which we don't involve in our science now, our materialist science. We don't study energies, we study hunks of matter. Rather than, we don't work at the level of these psychical and spiritual energies that compose everything and which stem from and interact with our consciousness. That's the real technology. The real technology is telementational. Discover and explore how your consciousness creates reality. All beings' consciousness creates reality. And that's sort of it's hard to explain, but from my understanding, it's just sort of a playful process. I know it sounds kind of trite and silly, but that is really what it is. It's a more... it's not as intense and robust as you'd think, from what I can tell. It's sort of just it's sort of just what we are. We are beings of, we are technology. Our consciousness is a technology that goes beyond the tinker toy type of technology that I discussed last week. We try to fit blocks together to create things. The real technology, the spiritual technology on the level of soul and forces is involves sort of spiritual ecstasy to carry out. And it does not involve a whole lot of working with your hands more than it involves working with your consciousness. There's a great quote in a book that I love on telementation, one of the books I quote in my book, Telementation, about how in telementation you learn to not do things with your hands, but you learn to do things with your consciousness. I was talking to Dr. Deagle today before I went on his show, and he was telling me that he's a really good shot with one of his guns. And he says he goes to ranges and shoots, and people say, "I can't believe how good you can shoot. How in the world do you do that?" And he says, "Because I shoot with my consciousness. The way he said is, I shoot with my mind's eye, with my astral eye. I don't shoot with my hands." That's exactly what I'm talking about here. When you have effort and strain and striving, you're not on the beam. You're off the beam. What you need is, as the Buddhists say, to stop doing. And then when you do that, everything falls into place, because the world is an outflux of your consciousness. And you can't really understand what I mean by that. It doesn't sound as mysterious as I mean it. You just have to really get into meditation and really get into your mysticism work to understand what I mean by that. It's not as it's sort of right there in front of your face, and you don't even know it right now if you don't know what I'm talking about. And it's a it's basically the spiritual power that you can tell that they're talking about in the religious texts. The light of God that crippled, momentarily crippled Saul on his road to Damascus. Whatever this telementational force, this force of ecstasy, the dragon consciousness, you can tell that all the religious texts are talking about that. You can tell that the ancient shamans and kings, for some reason, know about this but don't want to openly tell everybody, as I'm doing now. Because there's just no point. People won't understand. People are thinking about cheeseburgers and Michael Jackson's funeral on TV and all this kind of stuff. So it's, you know, what's the point? Plus to try to tell someone that's exerting effort, and that's in some ways it's contrary to the spiritual path. The spiritual path is about exerting your psychical consciousness. Okay. And just expanding it. The nature of all things is to expand, as I've heard Esther Hicks say that one time very elegantly, and I've been also thinking that for years. And we have the Earth expanding, the Big Bang theorists tell us the universe is expanding. You've got consciousness expanding, flowers expand, the atmospheres of planets expand. Everything, if you look at everything, it's sort of as if everything is expanding. That's the natural motion of things, is to move outward. And perhaps like an explosion. That's why I think people who get into meditation are often fascinated with pictures of flowers that are blooming, or explosions, or fireworks, or things like that, things that are moving outward. It's called a patulous movement. So I think that's what our ancients were concerned with. A technology which is such that their consciousness, their inner, deepest inner feeling states are integrated with energies outside of them. So I think I'm going to leave it at that for this edition of the Antimatter Radio Show. And I don't know if there'll be a part three of the nature and religion, nature of archaeology and religion, before we move into our series on religion, the nature of religion itself. But keep an eye on antimatterradio.com, the schedule, to see when certain future shows will show up. Everything's in the archives at antimatterradio.com. And all those archives are free, of course. I hope that you enjoy this material, because I think that humanity, it's time for us to get out of the dark age and to realize that the true course of our existence is ecstasy. It is not improvement. It's not self-improvement. It's not more material technology. Our next stage is ecstasy. And that's spirituality. That's what the religions have told us existed long ago. It's time for us to get that back.